Hello everyone, my name is Will and this is the MedEd Podcast. Today we'll be discussing an approach to the adult trauma patient. Specifically, we'll be going over the primary survey today. I just want to take a minute and emphatically state that none of this information should substitute the judgment of a professional. This is solely for educational purposes. I did not intend it for anything else. Attempting to perform many of the maneuvers discussed herein by an untrained person can result in significant morbidity and mortality. So the outline is pretty simple for today. We're going to be covering what a trauma is, and then we'll cover how to complete a primary survey. We will also quickly go through some of the diagnostic tests and therapeutic measures that you can take prior to even completing your secondary survey. I think it's important to mention that today we will not be discussing critical care patients, and we will not be discussing emergency room patients. We will not even discuss the secondary survey in a trauma patient until a later episode. So let's start this discussion off with a case. So you have a 27-year-old male who presents to the trauma bay following a high-speed head-on motor vehicle accident. He is unresponsive, he has weak palpable femoral pulses, and is tachycardic. His right leg is visibly deformed with a bone protruding from the skin and the open wound around the bone is bleeding profusely. What are you going to do next? Well, let's talk about it. We should start this discussion by first defining what type of patient is actually going to present to the trauma bay. So the type of patient that will present will be any patient with immediate threat to life or limb, usually following some sort of injury. Typically, the types of injuries can be blunt force wounds, penetrating wounds, and burns, or any mixture of the three. You can expect to see patients presenting due to motor vehicle accidents, falls from a large height, and patients that are victims of stab wounds or gunshot wounds. This is certainly not all-encompassing of a trauma patient, but it's a good place to start thinking. So let's begin discussion about the primary survey. Note that before you even see the patient, you'll often have information sent in from emergency medical services. You will often know the age, or at least an estimate, the gender, and the mechanism of injury. So there is a mnemonic for the primary survey. Do you know what it is, and do you know what each letter stands for? So the mnemonic is A, B, C, D, E, where D and E actually kind of leak over into the secondary survey a little bit. But nonetheless, they stand for airway, breathing, circulation, disability, and exposure/environment, respectively. Now, at most trauma centers, each of these critical components to survival will be managed in parallel by multiple providers in the room. In the case of the test, or in the event that you decide to become a rural doctor, the mnemonic also lists the order in which you should perform your primary survey. Now, something I'm going to say here and not bring up again is that you need to maintain C-spine precautions throughout your primary survey in the event that you have a patient in whom you cannot rule out a spinal injury. This will largely be determined by the location and mechanism of injury. So I will give you a second, and you can think about how you will assess the airway of a trauma patient. So something really simple you can do immediately is ask the patient, "What is your name?" This will assess both the airway as well as the mental function of the patient. One scenario is that they do not respond. For the sake of brevity, we'll say that this is because they're unconscious. And if they're unconscious, they're going to have a difficult time protecting their airway. Remember that the number one cause of an upper airway obstruction is actually the tongue slipping back into their airway and blocking it. Another scenario is that they may have voice changes, or that you may hear gurgling or choking or sputtering. All of these may suggest that the patient has increased risk for aspiration, and in such a case, you would want to consider an advanced airway. So another way to assess the airway simultaneously while you speak with them is you can just look at their face and neck. You can look for blood, wounds, anatomic deformities, as well as pooling secretions. Except in the cases that I will list in a minute, you'll want to attempt to manage the upper airway prior to managing the lower airway. You can do this with nasopharyngeal and oropharyngeal airways. You can use suction to get rid of secretions or blood. You can do a jaw thrust and a chin lift as well to help move the tongue out of the way. The main question you're going to have to answer at this point is when to move to orotracheal intubation, or also when you should opt for a surgical airway. So some examples of when to intubate. You can intubate at GCS 8, intubate at 8 or less. GCS is the Glasgow Coma Scale, which we'll discuss later. You could also intubate for respiratory failure, inhalation injury, or progressive loss of the airway. A surgical airway is when intubation is indicated but not possible, such as due to an obstruction blocking the tube, or severe facial or neck trauma that distorts the anatomy. What is the name of the procedure that you will do typically in this situation? That is a cricothyroidotomy, which is for emergency purposes and is only temporary, as opposed to a tracheostomy, which is actually inserted into the trachea, and this is typically reserved for your critical care patients that are on long-term intubation. This is usually a scheduled surgery, not an emergency surgery. Great, so after airway, we move on to breathing. Now, how do we assess breathing? So again, you can observe, look for chest rise and fall. You can look for jugular venous distension. You can also perform auscultation of the chest as well as percussion. Although you should know that it is extremely difficult to auscultate the chest in a busy trauma bay. One big thing you can't forget about is the monitors, and you need to look up at the monitors and look at their O2 sats. And correlate that with the clinical picture, such as looking for cyanosis of the skin. Many of these patients will be receiving oxygen. One common mistake and myth is that speaking implies breathing. In certain scenarios, a patient might be able to speak, but they will not be able to breathe or ventilate. The big question on my mind when assessing a patient's breathing is whether this patient has a pneumothorax versus a tension pneumothorax versus a hemothorax versus a sucking chest wound versus a flail chest. What does a tension pneumothorax look like? It looks like a pneumothorax in the sense that there will be hyperresonance to percussion as well as decreased breath sounds around the pneumothorax, but a tension pneumothorax may also show jugular venous distension as well as hypotension and possibly tracheal deviation. This is a crucial difference because you'll need to manage a tension pneumothorax immediately. The treatment is with emergent needle decompression. Now, classic wisdom suggests that this should occur at the second intercostal space at the midclavicular line along the same side as the pneumothorax. But the 10th edition of the Advanced Trauma Life Support, or ATLS, guide suggests that you should continue doing this for pediatric patients, but recommends a 5th intercostal space anterior to the mid-axillary line for adults. Now, a sucking chest wound is a type of open pneumothorax. This usually occurs with large open wounds in the chest cavity. Air will actually preferentially be pulled through this hole in the chest cavity, rather than through the physiological airways of the patient. This particular type of pneumothorax is managed by placing a dressing impermeable to air over the wound and taping it along all but one of its edges. This will effectively create a one-way valve letting air out but not in. Now let's contrast a hemothorax to a pneumothorax. A hemothorax will typically show dullness to percussion instead of hyperresonance. You may also see tracheal deviation if it is a severe hemothorax. Pneumothorax and hemothorax are both managed with a chest tube. This includes your tension pneumothorax after you've completed an emergency needle decompression. We will discuss surgical indications at the end. Finally, we have a flail chest, which is when you have two or more ribs broken in two or more places. And this will be quite apparent on inspection of the chest wall because the flail segment will move paradoxically compared to with the rest of the chest, which means it will move opposite from the rest of the chest wall. You can manage a flail chest temporarily by putting the patient on positive pressure ventilation. Okay, so now let's move on to the C in our primary survey, which stands for what? Circulation. How are you going to assess the circulation of a trauma patient? You could look at heart rate, blood pressure, pulse pressure, skin perfusion, urinary output, and active external bleeding. Your earliest sign for blood loss and eventual hypovolemic shock is actually tachycardia. Narrowed pulse pressure is also an early sign. One of the first steps to managing circulation is going to be gaining peripheral IV access, usually in the form of two large bore IVs, that is 16 gauge or less IV catheters. Interosseous access is possible, as well as central IV placement. Do not be fooled, however, that despite the large gauge of the central IVs, the length of the catheter will actually lead to a slower rate of infusion compared to shorter peripheral IVs. Central catheters are necessary, however, if you intend to use pressors. Nearly all trauma patients presenting with shock are actually going to have hypovolemic shock. Generally, a liter of isotonic IV fluid such as lactated Ringer's or normal saline is given to correct hypotension. Now, traditional wisdom suggests using ample amounts of IV fluids early. Recent research suggests, however, that too much IV fluid in a trauma patient can dilute coagulation factors and lead to more bleeding. So, whereas before 1 to 2 liters of IV fluids were often suggested for these patients, now it is recommended that IV fluids only be used judiciously, and generally only a liter is recommended. Patients that respond to the liter fluids, in other words, patients that stabilize, can go on to the secondary survey and further imaging and testing. Transient responders are patients that stabilize for a time but then become unstable again, and these patients will usually require blood products. Non-responders often need surgical or endovascular intervention, as well as blood products. Whole blood is generally considered ideal but difficult to store, so often a 1:1:1 ratio of platelets, packed red blood cells, and fresh frozen plasma will be given to the patient. So a circulatory problem in a trauma patient often suggests some sort of bleed. Massive hemorrhage leading to hypovolemic shock can come from injuries to the scalp, which is a highly vascular area of the body, and a lot of blood can be left at the scene of the injury so that when the patient arrives at the trauma bay, you can have an unrealistic image of how much the patient is actually losing. External bleeds are generally simple enough. It's the internal bleeding that is difficult, and there are four areas in the body where one can bleed out. Those are the chest, the abdomen, the pelvis, and the femurs. A common PIMP question is whether one can experience hemorrhagic shock due to bleeding internally into the skull. And the answer is no, although bleeding into the skull can cause death by compressing the brain. The cavity is not large enough to cause sufficient blood loss to lead to a hemorrhagic shock. So how are we going to fix all these possible causes? Well, if you have a scalp injury, you can fix it by stitching it. If you have a massive hemothorax, you can diagnose it with a chest x-ray, and initial management is placement of a chest tube. Intra-abdominal bleeds can be diagnosed with a FAST scan, which is an ultrasound, or a diagnostic peritoneal lavage only if the FAST is equivocal. And if the bleed does not stop on its own, it will often need exploratory laparotomy. Pelvic bleeds are often due to pelvic fractures leading to arterial lacerations. A pelvic bleed is often suspected if the other cavities are ruled out and if there's a high degree of clinical suspicion based off the presentation of the patient. These patients are initially managed with a pelvic binder to decrease the effective cavity of the pelvis, and then they are sent to interventional radiology for endovascular repair. Fractured long bones are often sent to orthopedic surgery to be reduced and fixated. One thing to note is that FAST scans will miss a retroperitoneal bleed. These bleeds are often only picked up on CT, and patients are generally only sent to CT when they are stable. Finally, we should talk about other non-hemorrhagic causes of shock in trauma. Three of the most common are cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, and neurogenic shock. Cardiac tamponade will often be seen on the FAST scan and can be suspected with Beck's triad, although this is a late finding. Beck's triad, by the way, is jugular venous distension, hypotension, and distant heart sounds. Treatment initially is with pericardiocentesis. We've already discussed how tension pneumothorax will present and how you manage it. And finally, you have neurogenic shock, which will present unusually with hypotension, but also with bradycardia instead of tachycardia. These patients will often need fluids and then pressors. Neurogenic shock is generally due to some sort of injury to the central nervous system, particularly spinal cord injuries. Next, we move on to the D in our primary survey, which is disability. You can quickly test for neurologic disability by asking the patient to move certain limbs or checking for sensation. Here is also where a Glasgow Coma Scale is typically filled out. The Glasgow Coma Scale, or GCS, is used to describe the level of impaired consciousness in a patient. Patients are scored from 3 to 15, with lower scores indicating more severe injury. The three categories of the GCS are opening eyes, speech, and movement. These are graded, respectively, from 1 to 4, 1 to 5, and 1 to 6. We will discuss the GCS in a future episode, especially because there have been some recent changes to it. Finally, we move on to the E in our primary survey, which stands for exposure or possibly environment, and this just means that you need to remove the clothes of the patient so that you can see all possible injury sites, as well as perform a log roll, all the while maintaining the warmth of the patient, usually with heated blankets. Remember that hypothermia is a component in the lethal triad of traumas, and that triad is formed by coagulopathy, acidosis, and hypothermia. They create a sort of vicious cycle, so it's good to keep your patients warm. One thing I didn't mention in all the tests that you can get for this patient are the labs that you'll often draw when placing the IVs. Common labs in a trauma are a CBC, a metabolic panel, a type and cross of the blood, as well as a PT-INR. All right, and some common questions for traumas. So when are you going to send this patient to get a thoracotomy? Well, that's if you have an unstable tamponade, as well as possibly a massive hemothorax, such as greater than 1.5 liters of blood loss when you put in a chest tube, or greater than 200 milliliters per hour, as well as any penetrating torso traumas that put the patient on the brink of death. When instead are you going to send this patient for a laparotomy? That would be if this patient has hypotension and a suspected peritoneal source, perhaps if the patient has peritonitis, evisceration, pneumoperitoneum, or a ruptured diaphragm or ruptured bowels. When are we going to send this patient to urology? That's if they have a suspected urinary tract injury, such as due to a pelvic fracture. This is often suspected if you see blood at the urethral meatus or if you find a high-riding prostate on a rectal exam. Many trauma patients will get a Foley catheter to monitor urinary output as well because they may be going to a surgery, but placement of a Foley catheter is contraindicated in a patient with suspected urethral injury. Once a urethral injury has been ruled out, a cystogram can be performed to identify other sources of hemorrhage within the urinary system. When are you going to send a patient to interventional radiology? That's usually if you have some sort of deep arterial injury. Finally, you have orthopedic surgery, and we already talked about this a little bit, but you'll definitely send them for long bone fractures that are leading to internal hemorrhage, and they'll likely be consulted for crush injuries or compartment syndrome. All right, well, this was a longer episode, and luckily the review will be brief. So what are the steps in the primary survey of a trauma patient? A, B, C, D, E, which stands for airway, breathing, circulation, disability, and exposure or environment. How will you check their airway? Ask them what their name is and listen for response, and examine their neck and face. Intubate for GCS 8 or less, respiratory failure, inhalation injuries, or progressive airway loss. Perform an emergency cricothyroidotomy if you cannot intubate. How do we assess for breathing? Put a pulse ox on the patient and monitor it. Observe for chest rise and fall, jugular venous distension, auscultate the chest, and percuss the chest. Further, you can observe the skin for cyanosis. Therapeutics are going to involve giving oxygen, fixing any suspected tension pneumothorax with an emergency needle decompression, and managing a pneumothorax or hemothorax with a chest tube. How are we going to assess a patient's circulation? We can look at heart rate, blood pressure, pulse pressure, skin perfusion, urinary output, and any active external bleeding. Therapeutics involve placing two large bore IVs, giving IV isotonic fluids judiciously, and often giving blood products early if the patient is suspected to be hemorrhaging. Diagnostics include a chest X-ray looking for a massive hemothorax or possibly a pneumothorax, and a FAST scan. A CT scan is possible if the patient is stable. Don't forget that while you are placing the IVs, you can collect a CBC, metabolic panel, type and cross of the blood, and a PT-INR. How do we assess for disability? We can look for movement and sensation, and assess the patient on a Glasgow coma scale. Finally, how do we expose the patient? We remove all of their clothes, and we give them a warm blanket. Okay, so that's it for the rapid review. I just want to quickly reiterate that this is all for educational purposes only. At no point should this information be used to substitute the professional judgment of a provider. Okay, everyone, I hope this was helpful. I hope that you're healthy and happy, and I'll catch you next time. Hey, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone for listening. And just to remind you that this content is for educational purposes only. So it is not to be used to replace a healthcare provider in making clinical decisions. I also want to give credit to Broke for Free, who wrote this song entitled Night Owl. Please contact me if you have any questions at mededpodcast@gmail.com. That's meded, M-E-D-E-D, podcast@gmail.com.